You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. The TV Business by Gabriel Sherman. Lachlan's Trump Trap. He's caught between Fox News' outrageous anchors and the president. Opening illustration by Joe Cardello. In the illustration, President Trump is in the foreground, scowling, looking off to the side. In the background is the Fox News logo, and Lachlan Murdoch is standing behind President Trump, arms crossed, not looking very happy either. One evening, not long after he was appointed Fox Corp CEO, Lachlan Murdoch invited Modern Family co-creator Steve Levitan for dinner at Giorgio's in Santa Monica. Murdoch was trying to quell a nascent rebellion. Levitan, whose Emmy Award-winning sitcom is produced by Fox's entertainment division and has been the longest-running comedy series on ABC, had joined Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane and Ghostbusters director Paul Feig in publicly denouncing Fox News' cheerleading of Trump's immigration policies. "I'm disgusted to work at a company that has anything whatsoever to do with that Fox News. This bullshit is the opposite of what hashtag Modern Family stands for," Levitan wrote on June 18th in response to Fox News host Laura Ingraham's calling migrant children detention facilities along the Mexican border essentially summer camps. Like many in the media business, Levitan hoped that the ascension of the younger generation of Murdochs would usher in more moderate politics at Fox News. Glasnost, at long last. Levitan told Lachlan that Fox News was destroying America and implored him to control Ingraham, Sean Hannity, and Tucker Carlson. A person briefed on the conversation told me. But Lachlan quickly dashed that dream. According to the source, Lachlan told Levitan that he wasn't embarrassed by Fox News. He reminded Levitan that the Murdochs had never censored shows like his, or The Simpsons, or Family Guy, so why couldn't Levitan live with a few conservative voices on one cable news network? For Lachlan at the time, the call was easy enough. The Murdochs were in the process of divesting themselves of Levitan's show, along with the rest of the family's entertainment business, in a $71 billion deal with Disney. The Trump-hostile assets would be gone. Peace would reign in Murdoch world. But for Lachlan and Fox, the Trump dissonance didn't end post-Disney deal. In some ways, it's even gotten worse. The network has never been more powerful, and at the same time so vulnerable. Fox programs influence Trump daily, but that has opened the network up to charges that it is state TV. Inside Fox, a long-running Cold War between the network's journalist and right-wing primetime host has turned hot. Fox journalists, bristling at being branded an arm of the Trump White House, are lobbying Fox News CEO Suzanne Scott and President Jay Wallace to rein in Fox and Friends, Sean Hannity, Lou Dobbs, and Jeanine Pirro. "Reporters are telling management that we are being defined by the worst people on our air," a frustrated senior Fox staffer told me last month. News staffers are feeling emboldened to go after Trump in increasingly visible ways. Fox's opinion hosts, meanwhile, have made the case that the primetime lineup not only reflects the audience's worldview, but is responsible for the majority of the network's advertising revenue and fees paid by cable companies that carry Fox. "We make the money," an anchor close to Hannity told me. According to a source, primetime staff complained to Fox management in March when a Muslim producer on Bret Baier's staff tweeted criticism of Jeanine Pirro. "You can't have a producer attacking talent. Roger Ailes would never have allowed that," a primetime staffer said. While Fox's primetime shows generate the lion's share of the network's ratings and ad revenues, there have been increasing issues with lost advertising. Many blue-chip companies don't want to buy time on those shows because of the divisive pro-Trump content. Executives are very worried Fox and Friends will be next. "If advertisers start bailing on them, they're screwed," an insider said. Marianne Gambelli, Fox's president of ad sales, responded, "Advertisers know the value of our loyal and engaged audience, and we expect no change in our business going forward." Going forward, though, Lachlan is in a trap. He can't simply issue a directive to temper the pro-Trump coverage to win back advertisers and calm restive reporters, because he would risk antagonizing the network's most important viewer, Trump. That happened in March when Fox suspended Jeanine Pirro for delivering an offensive monologue questioning Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar's patriotism. Trump quickly criticized Fox and lashed out at Fox journalists, tweeting, "We're at Fox News weekend anchors, at Arthel Neville, and at Leland Vedder trained by CNN prior to their ratings collapse. In any event, that's where they should be working, along with their lowest-rated anchor, Shepard Smith." He implored Fox to keep fighting for Tucker. Media Matters had uncovered a series of offensive statements Tucker Carlson had made while calling into Bubba the Love Sponge's radio show and fight hard for at Judge Jeanine. Inside Fox, staffers speculated Pirro would be fired, two sources told me, but Trump preempted such a move by calling Rupert Murdoch to complain about her suspension. Fox agreed to allow Pirro to come back on the air, but cut her opening monologue, a venue for her most incendiary rhetoric. "When Trump found out about that, he called Rupert again," a source said. A compromise was proposed. Pirro could return and deliver a shortened version of her opening statement. Trump called Rupert, and Rupert put pressure on the executives, a source briefed on the conversations told me. The White House did not respond to her request for comment. A spokesperson for Fox News said the network's management never discussed canceling Pirro's show. Another risk that Lachlan faces if he intervenes in Fox's programming is antagonizing Trump's favorite host. According to sources, Hannity is still angry over the Murdochs' firing of Fox News CEO Roger Ailes and co-president Bill Shein, Hannity's close friend and former producer. Hannity believes the Murdochs are out to get Trump. Hannity told Trump last year that the Murdochs hate Trump, and Hannity is the only one holding Fox together, a source who heard the conversation told me. Hannity has told Friends that he intends to leave Fox when his contract expires in early 2021. Two people who've spoken with him said, "Sean doesn't feel supported," a staffer close to him said. "He has no relationship with Lachlan. Sean thinks, 'Wait a second, I was hired to get ratings, and I get ratings, but now people are embarrassed about me.'" He feels Fox spends a lot of time supporting Shepard Smith, but his show makes no money. That's annoying to him. Hannity did not respond to a request for comment. In the short term, Lachlan is likely to stay the course. His politics are much more in line with his father's. There's a sigh of relief with James being gone. When he was around, we were worried we would put something on the air that pissed off James's wife, a former Fox executive said, referring to Catherine Murdoch, an environmentalist who once worked at the Clinton Climate Initiative. But Fox staffers share Hannity's view that in the long run, Fox could drift to the center. Though Lachlan hired West Wing stalwart Hope Hicks, staffers believe he is likely to nudge the network away from its close marriage to Trump. Sources close to Lachlan pointed out that Lachlan is a libertarian conservative, not a MAGA diehard, who in private has expressed annoyance at Trump. He doesn't like Trump, one person who has spoken with Lachlan told me. There's a lot of talk of the direction of the network changing under Lachlan, the senior Fox staffer said. Sources also pointed out the hiring of Donna Brazile and the appointment of sometime Trump critic Paul Ryan to Fox Corp's board as signs of Lachlan's view on Trump. Donna is a shot in that direction, the staffer said. Management knows they have an image problem. But the staffer cautioned that any changes will be modest, at least at first. Lachlan is not James. A spokesman for Lachlan declined to comment. A person close to Lachlan said, Fox has been underestimated dating back to its inception as the fourth major network and continues to challenge conventional wisdom, exceeding expectations as a strategically bold, transformational media brand. That won't change. Indeed, Fox News transformed American politics, shaping and motivating the voters that Trump stepped in to claim. But now, creating distance from Trump may be the necessary first step in a larger strategy. Some believe it's inevitable that the Murdochs will sell Fox News. Everyone thinks they're going to sell it. It's too small to be independent, the anchor told me. Now here's this month's cover story by Krista Smith, with photographs by Collier Shore, styled by Samira Nasser. A hit TV show, film roles only she can pull off, a career that gets ever better, Plusa Kidman, Nicole Kidman, shapeshifter. Opening photos, to die for, Nicole Kidman, photographed in Franklin, Tennessee. Nicole Kidman is one of the first few movie stars. Nicole Kidman is one of the few movie stars left in Hollywood. Her chameleonic acting abilities are legend. Her beauty, profuse. She is poised and regal, a perennial showstopper. It's hard to imagine that she is even human. Almost 2 hours into our hike in Nashville's Radnor Lake State Park, however, Kidman becomes undeniably mortal. "I have to pee," she announces. "That makes two of us." Looking around, we see nothing but road ahead and road behind. "It's 30 minutes this way," she gestures, "and an hour that way." Then in her lilt says, "And I think we may be lost." I look her straight in the eye and break the news. "We're going to have to go in the great outdoors." Dressed all in black, parka, beanie, cargo pants, sneakers, and backpack, carrying coffee, water, and apples, and not a stitch of makeup on, the Glamazon climbs a small hill and flashes those baby blues. "Remember, it was you who didn't want to go to a cafe." Then, from behind the tree, "Keep asking me questions." Our hike around the roughly 1,400-acre natural reserve is not the first time our paths have crossed. In Australia, shortly after she married Keith Urban, she giddily told me about her hope to give birth. In Los Angeles last year, she courageously ate worms for Vanity Fair's Secret Talent Theater, a heroic display still collecting views on YouTube. This time, we're on a dirt trail winding through nature where you could easily get lost for hours, and we nearly did, looking for a notoriously elusive owl. Despite the cold, we pass a few clusters of people, some carrying long-lens cameras. "That's our paparazzi," Kidman says with a laugh. But we're in Nashville, and here the sights are trained on actual wildlife. A group of young women passes us, and I'm shocked none even do a double take at the Oscar, Golden Globe, SAG Award, and Emmy-winning star. "No wonder you love Nashville," I tell her. "Total privacy," she concurs. I learn, over my time spent here, that Nashville etiquette means letting people live their lives in peace. See, this is why I live here. This bucolic Tennessee life offers respite from Kidman's wildly dynamic and duly prolific career, making her a once-in-a-generation talent with no signs of slowing down. There was the role that ignited it all in Dead Calm, 1989. She took a risky star turn that paid off in Gus Van Sant's To Die For, 1995, then stayed busy with big studio films like Eyes Wide Shut, 1999, Oscar-nominated Moulin Rouge, 2001, and in that same year, The Others. She got her Best Actress Oscar for playing Virginia Woolf in The Hours, 2002. More obscure artistic adventures followed. Lars von Trier's Dogville, 2003, had her crawling on all fours in a dog crawler. Birth, 2004, drew controversy for a scene in which Kidman bathed with a child. Films like The Stepford Wives, 2004, Bewitched, 2005, and The Interpreter, 2005, skewed more commercial, though to less acclaim. In Fur, 2006, as Diane Arbus, she shaves Robert Downey Jr.'s entire body. She launched her production company, Blossom Films, with the festival hit Rabbit Hole, then pushed new limits in Lee Daniels' follow-up to Precious, The Paperboy. Last year, she was nearly unrecognizable in the gritty neo-noir Destroyer, and then as the southern mother to a gay son in the conversion therapy film Boy Erased. Both, while DC Comics' Aquaman grossed more than $1 billion. Big Little Lies, the 7-part series that received 19 nominations and 13 awards, marked a return to the small screen, where she got her start as a teenager in Australia. This Vanity Fair cover makes her 10th. I've done weird films, and I've done things that are so obtuse, which I'm still committed to, because I like performance art and not conforming to what everyone expects of you. I don't think in normal terms. She laughs as she tells me, Keith always says, you're so not mainstream. Kidman made Nashville her home 13 years ago, after she and Urban got married. To put things in perspective, her 10-year marriage to Tom Cruise ended 2 decades ago. Urban, last year's Country Music Association Awards Entertainer of the Year and 2019's Academy of Country Music Awards Entertainer of the Year, sells out arenas worldwide. But despite their doubly blinding megawattage as a couple, it's extremely simple with what we want from each other and what we want from a relationship. Just peas in a pod in that regard, says Kidman. She loves being a tour wife and says she can memorize his tour schedule and dates in one glance. I love that Keith is a guitar player and a singer, but his passion is guitar and writing music, she says. That's what I'm around every day. The whole family loves music. Faith, 8, plays violin. Sunday, 10, who was playing piano that morning, is also interested in her mother's line of work. Sunday showed me an iPad film, a hospital drama, that she made with her friends. Maybe it's just a phase. Neither parent pressures the children to follow in their footsteps. You can't really get kids into anything, I've realized. You can push them a bit, but motivation is a really hard thing. I mean, nobody motivated me to be an actor. If anything, they tried to deter me. Kidman loved Gwyneth Paltrow's Mother's Day Goop podcast because Paltrow and Blythe Danner explored their mother-daughter relationship in the context of their shared industry. Though Kidman is jet-lagged, just back from Europe the night before, Urban has been on his Graffiti U World tour. She has already chaperoned a 4th-grade trip to the state capital this morning. Kidman and Urban are involved parents. In the unique way, that means for ones who go on world tours or movie sets and bring the girls plus tutors along. Kidman keeps them with her as often as possible when she's working. Or flies home constantly, even during intense shoots. Yet in other ways, Sunday and Faith sound like any other kids. Kidman says her parental policies might even make her unpopular. They don't have a phone, and I don't allow them to have an Instagram, she says. I try to keep some sort of boundaries. Kidman's children with Cruz are now adults. Their son, Connor, is in music, and Kidman tells me lives in Miami. Their daughter, Bella, is married and recently launched the T-shirt line BKC, Bella Kidman Cruz. Bella lives just outside London. You know, she really feels more English. We lived there for Eyes Wide Shut, Mission Impossible, and The Portrait of a Lady, says Kidman. They both had English accents when they were little. Next photos, eyes wide open. My mom always told us to get a cause. From the UN to Stanford's Women's Cancer Center, Kidman got several. And Portrait of a Lady. Kidman is that historical Hollywood age when women are expected or forced to fade to black. Instead, she burns bright as ever. Motherhood has allowed Kidman to flex her mind in other ways. She says people are shocked by how good she is with numbers, though it's always a challenge to get her kids to do their schoolwork, and that brings a certain agility to her day job. Kidman's producing partner of 10 years, Per Sari, confirms she's as analytical as she is creative. She's able to sit down and look at a budget and work that as magically as she's able to sit down with a script and arc a character. Her superpower is her brain, and she never forgets anything. I've never seen anything like it. This spring, Blossom Films began shooting The Undoing, based on the book You Should Have Known by Jean Hanf Korelitz. The 6-part series is directed by Suzanne Beer, and Kidman has reteamed with Big Little Lies' David E. Kelly to write and executive produce. Hugh Grant and Donald Sutherland will star with Kidman. Additionally, Blossom just signed a first-look deal with Amazon Studios and already has a series, The Expatriates, in pre-production. At 51, Kidman is that historical Hollywood age when women, especially leading ladies, are expected or forced to fade to black. Perhaps a Broadway role or cameo as the lights dim. Instead, Kidman burns bright as ever. After the success of 2018 are two pivotal roles as Mrs. Barber in The Goldfinch and Gretchen Carlson in Jay Roach's still-untitled Roger Ailes biopic. There isn't a shelf life like there used to be, Kidman tells me. That's why it's so important to keep changing. We live longer now, if we're fortunate, so there has to be a place to put all that creative energy. And there's the second season of Big Little Lies with Reese Witherspoon, Laura Dern, Zoe Kravitz, and Shailene Woodley, debuting next month on HBO. Kidman says that after 30 years of doing no TV, she was pleasantly surprised by how much she cherished all that time she spent with her co-stars. To watch Zoe and Shailene grow up and to see them become women, it's so nice, and I've never had that. I know Laura and Reese feel that too. We're all so different, yet we complement each other. She says the whole cast plans to attend Kravitz's wedding to actor Carl Glusman. Witherspoon says they all love to tease Kidman about the little snack bag she carries around. It's very idiosyncratic snacks. We always make fun of her old lady hard candies, always butterscotch and peppermint. Nicole and I talk about this often. I'd been in a show with maybe one other woman, but never 5 female leads, says Witherspoon. I never even had that many conversations on screen with women who had the same size part as me. It's pretty amazing to get to work with this group. I feel like it's a singular experience I'll never have again. Meryl Streep says that camaraderie is why she didn't hesitate when the call came to join the cast for the second season. The fans wanted more. I wanted more. I signed on without even knowing what the part was, because I had such confidence in this group and just how smart they all are and how high the bar was going to be. Kidman nods to the prototypical happy ensemble. Look at the Friends cast. They spent all that time together. They're different because there are no men in our equation. I mean, there are, but they're not on the group chat, let's put it that way. Wait, Nicole, Reese, Laura, Zoe, and Shailene have a group chat? What about Meryl? Yes, says Kidman, and she's very funny. Witherspoon describes the ultimate girls' night. Can you imagine that we got to go to dinner with Meryl every week and hear her stories? It's like years and years of actresses being siloed off, and finally they let us intermingle. You can only imagine the conversations that we had. It was a really amazing experience of sharing our indignities and our triumphs and just every rainbow of the female experience in our business. Big Little Lies, based on the book by Leanne Moriarty, is about 5 women, all mothers, in the affluent Northern California community of Monterey, a tour de force of female complexity in all its beauty and ugliness. Nicole and Reese joined forces with their separate production companies and brought it to life at HBO. We read it at the same time, and we both wanted it, Witherspoon tells me. So instead of going against each other, we got on the phone and decided to partner and to do it together. Richard Plepler, then CEO of HBO, recalls, I remember as the cuts were coming in and the quality of storytelling and the performances, we knew immediately that it was something quite magical. Just watching Kidman in the scene where she is alone with the therapist dancing around the semantics of domestic violence is a masterclass in acting. As directed by Jean-Marc Vallée and written by Kelly with Moriarty, Kidman's performance went on to receive 3 Best Actress wins, a SAG Award, a Golden Globe, and an Emmy. When it came time for a second season, no one was contractually obligated, and there was no source material, as the book didn't have a sequel. As Sari says, there was an enormous appetite amongst the people watching the show, so we started thinking, we do end the first season with a cliffhanger. This cop is sitting there with the binoculars. There is an open-ended story. So we went to Leanne and asked her if she could write a book. That 200-page novella has never been published, and the plot is shrouded in secrecy. Kidman would only relay, I hope there's an enormous amount of truth. It's the aftermath of a death. Kelly returned to write the teleplay, and Andrea Arnold was brought in to direct, with Vallée staying on as a producer. Kidman tells me, Mark's still very much the father of the series. His vocabulary was set in the first one, and then Andrea got to mine us for different emotions. Street plays Mary Louise, the mother-in-law of Kidman's Celeste, who comes to town to get to the bottom of the death of her son. Streep tells me about their first day on set together. Right off the bat, she did a scene where she had to do something really, really hard, like waking up out of nothing and going right into sort of a breakdown. She did it over and over and over again to the point where I thought, is she being harmed in this process? Says Streep, I scurried over to the director and I said, don't you think you have it? I mean, I've done this before with other people because I know what it takes to do that. She was okay. It's just like she has a kind of a placid, very quiet reserve that sits on top of this titanic power. Streep says this season we will see more of that from Kidman. I'm in awe of her. She's like a secret soft Valkyrie with a spine like steel. She's very disciplined, but it's all in protection of a very tender self. You forget, Streep continues, that she's 6 feet tall, you know. But she is 6 feet tall, and sometimes she raises all of it up, and it's wow. That's what you see in the end of this series. You see the full height of Nicole. Kidman was raised by intellectuals. Her mother, Janelle, a nursing instructor in Sydney, and her father, Anthony Kidman, a biochemist, clinical psychologist, and author. Her father died unexpectedly from a heart attack in 2014, and the pain of that loss is still acute with his eldest daughter. Kidman and her younger sister, Antonia, were reared on conversations about politics and philosophy every night at dinner. From an early age, they were taught to think for themselves, to question, and most important, to give back. My mom always told us to get a cause. Kidman got several. In 2006, she was appointed Goodwill Ambassador for UN Women. Last year, she donated $500,000 to support the UN Trust to End Violence Against Women. With Big Little Lies and the role of Celeste, she took on an additional role, working with advocates and survivors, says Estes Soler, who runs the nonprofit Futures Without Violence. 2 days after winning the Emmy, she came to San Francisco and stood with survivors and advocates to promote prevention and education. Kidman takes the lessons into her own home, though she concedes it's a challenge. I was talking to Sunday about there being little girls in different parts of this world who don't own their bodies. A man owns their body. Her eyes were like, what? We're trying to educate about those things, but it's giving the information gently and then guiding. Jonathan Barek, currently of Stanford Women's Cancer Center, first met Kidman 28 years ago when he was at UCLA. At the time, Kidman's mother, Janelle, was in the midst of breast cancer treatment. I credit Nick with being the catalyst that created Stanford Women's Cancer Center under one umbrella. It was just our 10th anniversary, and Keith performed. We raised $3.5 million, which brings our total for the fundraising at about $52 million. Back home in Australia, where the family manages to spend time at least twice a year, her involvement with the Sydney Children's Hospital is well known. She buys holiday presents every year for the staff and the children and never misses an opportunity to visit. The dedication Nicole pays to her acting is mirrored in her dedication to sick kids, says Vanessa Johnston, head of communications for the Children's Hospital. On a recent visit, I witnessed her steal a moment with Keith, where they both shed a tear before continuing. Kidman finds herself crying a lot these days. She has a strong belief in God and isn't afraid to say it out loud. A lot of my friends tease me. The Kidman Urbans go to church as a family. That's how we are raising our children. Keith has his own beliefs, but he comes too. I had a very Catholic grandmother, and I was raised praying, so that had massive impact. I wouldn't say it's absolutism. There's constant questioning. I'm a willful, feisty girl. For me, it's very important that I don't have judgment. My dad would always say, tolerance is the most important thing. After I descend the hill from my turn behind the tree, I ask Kidman why she finds herself frequently on the verge of tears. Because, Krista, life. Like most people at the mid-century mark, she has considered her own mortality. I'm far more raw and honest now, because before I used to be so scared. So now I'm just like, what the hell? Share. Share ideas. Share. And it's not safe to do that sometimes, because you're suddenly exposed. But at the same time, it makes you feel closer to people. Then I see the owl. Kidman has the excitement of a child on Christmas morning. We both whip out our phones to get a picture. Kidman, in another mortal moment, can't get hers to work. I snap one, but the bird is so well camouflaged, it just looks like part of the tree in the photo. We stop, put our phones away, and take in this beautiful creature in this beautiful place, and breathe in our gratitude. After all, I got to spend the afternoon with a unicorn, and we both got to see the owl.
Thank you.
double down. For Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, winning has always come naturally, even when they lose. And Bitcoin billionaires Ben Mezrich traces their crypto rise back to their money-making battle royale with Mark Zuckerberg and the conference room showdown featuring a booster seat, a handshake, and $65 million. This article is from Bitcoin Billionaires, A True Story of Genius, Betrayal, and Redemption by Ben Mezrich. Copyright 2019 by the author and reprinted by permission of Flatiron Books. Opening photo, out of the shadows, Cameron Winklevoss and Tyler Winklevoss attend the 2017 Met Gala at New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. February 22, 2008. The 23rd floor of a nondescript office tower on the outskirts of San Francisco's financial district. The usual glass, steel, and concrete sliced and diced into overly air-conditioned, brightly lit cubes. Eggshell-colored walls and industrial beige carpets. Fluorescent strips bisecting tic-tac-toe tiled drop ceilings. Bug-eyed water coolers, chrome-edged conference tables, faux leather adjustable chairs. It was a little past three on a Friday afternoon, and Tyler Winklevoss stood by a floor-to-ceiling window overlooking a pincushion of similar office buildings piercing the midday fog. He was trying his best to sip filtered water from a tissue-thin disposable cup without spilling too much onto his tie. After so many days, months, hell, years, the tie was hardly necessary. The longer this ordeal dragged on, the more likely it was that sooner or later he'd show up to the next endless session wearing his Olympic rowing jacket. He managed to get the barest taste of water before the cup folded inward beneath his fingers, rivulets missing his tie but drenching the sleeve of his dress shirt. He tossed the cup into a trash can beneath the window, shaking off his damp wrist. Another thing to add to the list, paper cups shaped like ice cream cones. What kind of sadist came up with these? Maybe the same guy who invented the lights. I've gotten two shades tanner since they moved us to this floor. Forget pits of fire. I'm betting purgatory is lined with fluorescent tubes. Tyler's brother, Cameron, was stretched out across two of the faux leather chairs on the other side of the room, his long legs propped up against the corner of a rectangular conference table. He was wearing a blazer, but no tie. One of his size 14 shoes rested perilously close to the screen of Tyler's open laptop, but Tyler let it slide. It had already been a long day. Tyler knew the tedium was by design. Mediation was different from litigation. The latter was a pitched battle. Two parties trying to fight their way to victory, what mathematicians and economists would call a zero-sum game. Litigation had highs and lows, but beneath the surface there lurked a primal energy. At its heart, it was war. Mediation was different. When properly conducted, there wasn't a winner or a loser, just two parties who had compromised their way to a resolution, who split the baby. Mediation didn't feel like war. It was more like a really long bus ride that ended only when everyone on board got tired enough of the scenery to agree on a destination. "If you want to be accurate," Tyler said, turning back to the window and the gray on gray of another Northern California afternoon, "we're not the ones in purgatory." Whenever the lawyers were out of the room, Tyler and Cameron did their best not to dwell on the case itself. There had been plenty of that in the beginning. They had once been so filled with anger and a feeling of betrayal that they could hardly think of anything else. But as the weeks turned into months, they had decided that anger wasn't doing their sanity any good. As the lawyers kept telling them, they had to trust in the system. So when they were alone, they tried to talk about anything but what had brought them to this place. that they were now on the topic of medieval literature, specifically Dante's conception of the many circles of hell, showed that the avoidance strategy was beginning to fray. Trusting the system had seemingly trapped them in one of Dante's inventions. Even so, it gave them something to focus on. As teenagers growing up in Connecticut, Tyler and Cameron had both been obsessed with Latin. With no courses left to take by senior year of high school, they petitioned their principal to let them form a medieval Latin seminar with a Jesuit priest who was the director of the Latin program. Together, the twins and the father translated the Confessions of St. Augustine and other medieval scholarly works. Though Dante hadn't written his most famous work in Latin, they'd also studied enough Italian to play the game of updating the scenery in his inferno. Water coolers, fluorescent lights, whiteboards, lawyers. Technically, Tyler said, we're in limbo. He's the one in purgatory. We didn't do anything wrong. There was a sudden knock. One of their own lawyers, Peter Calamari, entered first. Behind him came the mediator, Antonio Tony Piazza. Trim to the point of being gaunt, he was impeccably dressed in suit and tie. His snowflaked hair was shorn tight and proper, his cheeks appropriately tanned. In the press, Piazza was known as the master of mediation. He had successfully resolved more than 4,000 complex disputes, supposedly had a photographic memory, and was also an expert in martial arts. Believing that his training in Aikido had taught him how to channel aggression into something productive, Piazza was indefatigable. In theory, he was the perfect bus driver for this seemingly endless ride. Before the two lawyers had even shut the door behind them, Cameron had his legs off the table. Did he agree? He'd aimed the question at Piazza. In recent weeks, they'd begun to think of Calamari, a partner at the ever-boastful, chest-pounding Quinn Emanuel Law Firm, as little more than a messenger between them and the Aikido master. It's not a no, Piazza said, but he has some concerns. Tyler looked at his brother. The request they'd made had originally been Cameron's idea. They had spent so much time going back and forth through the lawyers, Cameron had wondered if maybe there was a way to cut through all the theater. They were three people who not long ago had met in a college dining hall. Maybe they could sit down again, just the three of them, no lawyers, and talk this thing through. What sort of concerns? Cameron asked. Piazza paused. Security concerns. It took Tyler a moment to realize what the man was saying. His brother stood up from his chair. He thinks we're going to take a swing at him? Cameron asked. Really? Tyler felt his cheeks growing red. You've got to be kidding. Their lawyer stepped forward, placating. The important thing is, other than the security concerns, he's amenable to the idea. Seriously, let me understand this, Tyler said. He thinks we're going to beat him up. During mediation, in the corporate offices of a mediator. Next, photos. Fight Club. Cameron and Tyler while training with the Oxford rowing team, 2010, and Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard, 2004. Piazza's face didn't change, but his voice shifted lower to an octave so soothing it could put you to sleep. Let's try to keep focus. He's agreed to the meeting in theory. It's just a matter of working out the details. You want to handcuff us to the water cooler? Cameron asked. Will that make him more comfortable? That won't be necessary. There's a glass conference room at the end of the hall. We can set the meeting there. Just one of you will go in for the face-to-face. The rest of us will sit outside and watch. It was utterly absurd. Tyler felt as though they were being treated like wild animals. Security concerns. He had a feeling the words themselves had come from him. They sounded exactly like something only he would say, or even think. Maybe it was some sort of ploy. The idea that he'd be any physically safer facing just one of them was almost as ludicrous as the idea that they'd beat him up. But maybe he thought talking to only one of them would give him some sort of intellectual advantage. The twins felt he'd judged them from the very beginning because of the way they looked. To him, they had always been nothing more than the cool kids on campus, dumb jocks who couldn't even code, who needed to hire a nerd to build their website, a website only he, the boy genius, could have, or rather should have, possibly invented. Because if they were the inventors, they would have invented it. Of course, by logic, they'd want to knock him out if they could get him in a room alone. Tyler closed his eyes, took a moment. Then he shrugged. Cameron will go in. His brother had always been a little more rounded at the edges, less alpha, more willing to bend when bending was the only option available. No doubt this would be one of those situations. Like a tiger in a cage, Cameron said, as they followed Piazza and their lawyer out into the hallway. Keep the tranquilizer gun ready. If you see me going for his throat, do me a favor and aim for the blazer. It's my brother's. Neither the lawyer nor the mediator cracked even the slightest of smiles. In 2009, when I published The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, which was adapted into the film The Social Network, I could never have guessed that one day I would revisit two of the characters from that story, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, the identical twins who challenged Mark Zuckerberg over the origins of what would soon be one of the most powerful companies on Earth. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.